Hi, everybody. You are listening to episode 19 of the Lady Splaney podcast. I am Lady Splaney herself, Alecheka, and we are continuing our mini-series on Tristan and Isolde. But before we jump into the story, we have to discuss something because I have been called out by a listener. So I need to address some of my Game of Thrones references. Okay, I just want to clarify here. I am not comparing Tristan to Theon Greyjoy because that would be ludicrous. What I am saying is that the use of the 30 kids as tribute in the story is kind of a fictional precedent. And also, you know, it's like a real historical thing that would happen. You lose in battle, and then you have to give up your son to be fostered to your enemy. It makes you a lot less likely that you're going to, like, later go on and attack your enemy. And it's going to make it much more likely that your son is going to, you know, maybe grow up and be an ally to the foster brother, foster father, you know, they grow up in the household. So I'm saying this is a fictional precedent to the also fictional occurrence of Theon Greyjoy being used as a tribute at the end of Robert's Rebellion. His dad sends him from the Iron Islands to go be raised at Winterfell with Ned Stark. I am, however, explicitly saying that Jon Snow, with his, like, broodiness, to me, has a little bit of the Tristan about him. I think Tristan is definitely a little influence here. I stand by this. I said what I said. Okay, so let's jump back in the story. When we left our hero, he had defeated Marholt by, you know, splitting his skull open with a sword. The sword chips while it's inside the skull. And Marholt's sister tries to save him, can't save him, but she does keep that little chip of sword. She takes out of, I guess like in brain surgery, puts it in a casket. Meanwhile, Tristram is wounded. He is gravely wounded from this thigh wound, which also has some magical poison. Okay, so returning to the story, Tristan lay sick in Tintagel, and none might cure his wound. And at length, the wise men told him that in Ireland lay the cure, for thence the poison came, and only Queen Isolde might be able to heal it. Tristan went to Ireland in disguise. He called himself the minstrel Tramtris, and sang so well that those who found him brought him to the court. Now Gurman and Isolde had one child only, the loveliest damsel in the world, whose name was Isolde. All men speak of her the world over as Isolde the Fair, and surely there is none fairer. These eyes have seen her, and they have seen beauties of many lands. Okay. Gonna pause. We're gonna dive in here a little bit. First of all, this is a very ballsy move on Tristan's part. He's just defeated Ireland's greatest hero, the greatest champion, and he is in fact gonna go back to Ireland in disguise and ask the man that he has killed, ask that man's sister to heal him. So that, you know, that's a ballsy move. One, two. How is he disguising himself? As a minstrel. And the minstrel who is telling us the story tells us that he is just like a very, very good singer. Next, I really want to dwell for a little moment on Isolde's name, specifically the way that she is called Isolde the Fair, because I am fascinated by the etymology of the word fair and what it reveals about Western culture. So first of all, the word fair has many, many, many meanings, but let's just concentrate on three. We're going to go on this little tangent on the etymology of the word fair. So one meaning of fair is morally good, all right? A second meaning of fair is beautiful, to be good looking, right? So if I am a fair person in business, then you think like, oh, you know, she's good. She's trustworthy. This is a morally correct person. If I say, oh, you know, my fair lady, then
we're not talking about, like, you know, my trash-looking lady. My fair lady is somebody who's very beautiful, is very appealing to the eye. The third meaning is pale, the opposite of dark. So consider for a moment how deeply messed up it is that we use the same word to mean white-skinned, morally correct, and beautiful. And also consider how deeply messed up it is that if that word is all of those things, then what's the opposite? So is the opposite of having pale white-skinned to be, is that a sign of moral degradation? Is that a sign of ugliness? And I would argue that the way that that word is used means that, like, yes, in Western culture, that is what white supremacy is, over and over and over and over again. I could walk in, I mean, this story was written, God, what, 1,000 years ago? I could show you, I just finished reading Midsummer Night's Dream with the class, and it's in that text as well. You've got these two best friends, Helena and Hermia, and one of them is tall and fair, and the other one is short and dark. And the second that they get into an ugly argument, the jugular that they go to, insult-wise, is that one of them calls the other, you Ethiope, right? They go straight there. You can jump forward in time to 2018, to right now. I could get in my car and go to Fiesta, which is one of my favorite grocery stores because, as I explained last episode, Lady Splaney is a Mexican lady. But in Latino culture, we're not immune to this truly insidious idea that the paler your skin is, the better a person you are, and the better looking you are. Fiesta has, still, in the beauty aisle, you can buy skin whitener. So there it is. She's called Isolde the Fair. Take it how you will, but look at it with a critical eye. Look at that word with a critical eye every single time you see it in literature. And just pause for a little second. Think like, huh, that's real messed up. That is real messed up. Okay, we're returning from our tangent. And let's learn about Isolde the Fair. So here she is. Germain and Isolde have one child only, loveliest damsel of all the world, whose name is Isolde. All men speak of her the world over as Isolde the Fair, and surely there is none fairer. These eyes have seen her. So these eyes is referring to the minstrel who is even now our narrator telling the story to Arthur. And returning to the story, and they have seen the beauties of many lands. King Germain wished greatly that his daughter should learn to play upon the harp, yet there was no man in Ireland skilled enough to teach her. He heard of the minstrel Trantris, whose harping all men praise, and he sent for him. Trantris came, born in a litter. A litter here meaning, you know, probably like a pallet that he's being carried on. You know, ladies might be in a litter, might be like a chair that they're lifted around on, or, you know, like I said, a pallet. Why is he being carried around in a litter instead of walking on his own 2 feet? Remember that he still has this, you know, horrible, horrible festering thigh wound. Okay, so Tram just came, born in a litter. This wound I got of pirates as I voyaged to Ireland, he told the king. That's a lie, y'all. He did not get that wound from the pirates. As you well remember, he got that wound from killing the king's brother-in-law and champion. But, you know, whatever. So Tristram, disguised as Trantris, is now, like, weaving this web of lies. This wound I got of pirates as I voyaged to Ireland, he told the king. I traveled with a merchant in a ship of rich merchandise, and the sea robbers took after us a fierce fight. They slew all on the ship, but me they spared because of my harping. And they set me in a little boat with food and water, and therein your people found me when I drifted at length near to the Irish coast. All right, all parts of this are hilarious. There is no part of this is not funny. So not only has, you know, Tristram done this, like, really ballsy thing, which is, you know, show up in Ireland to get the sister of the man that he killed to heal him. But now he is talking to, like, the brother of the man, brother-in-law of the man that he killed, weaving this web of lies, but they're incredibly self-serving lies, right? So he both wants to have this, like, kind of badass story. How did I get this wound? Pirates, right? But then he also has this like, just delightfully, like, I just don't even have words for how self-serving it is. And just how unbelievably ludicrous that his backstory, or the story that he is trying to feed the King of Ireland, is not only did I sustain this wound in a pitched battle with pirates, but, like, pirates who are also keen appreciators of this musical instrument, the harp. My harp playing was just so good, these pirates could not bear to kill me. Like, I can't exactly picture this scenario. Like, how do the pirates know that his harp playing is so good? Was he playing when they attacked the ship? While they were attacking the ship? Was he playing the harp? Like, he said that they were in a pitched battle. I don't know. There's, like, a lot of questions here. But the King of Ireland just seems like, you know, take this story at face value. And what he gets from it is, oh, like, you're really good at the harp. Great. My daughter needs a harp tutor. It's also worth noting that the story that he's telling, even though it is full of lies, it actually is a reflection of what has happened to him earlier in the story when he was kidnapped by the Norwegian merchants and set adrift, or set on a foreign shore, which in that case was Cornwall, and, you know, So there's a telling and a retelling with the shifting of events. Okay, so then the Queen Isoude tended Tramtris the minstrel so that his wound closed up and grew better day by day until he was whole again. And day by day he taught the fairy salt to play upon the harp and to sing, and his heart was stirred by her beauty. Yet still he set fame and deeds of arms before love, so that he wooed her not. Okay, so the two of them, they are free agents, they are seeing each other every day. You know, he's teaching her to play the harp. Take that as you will. His heart is stirred by her beauty, but he doesn't act. He doesn't act because, you know, he's still got these, you know, wild oats to sow, I guess. And also, I mean, she doesn't think that he's available because she's a princess and he's her harp tutor. Okay, for a year dwelt Tristram unknown in Ireland. And at the end of that time, he sailed back to Lyonnais into Cornwall and came to King Mark at Tintagel. Remember that Mark is his uncle. But King Mark had heard tell of Isoude the Fair. And when Tristram spoke of her, his royal heart was stirred. And he held counsel with his lords, saying to them, King Gorman of Ireland has no other child. Would it not be well for both our lands if we made a firm peace together, and I took the fair Isoude to wife? The nobles thought that this was indeed wise. But how may it be brought about? They asked. Gorman of Ireland and Isoude his queen hate us for the slaying of Marhalt, hate us also for the ceasing of our tribute. How then shall you win the hand of the Princess Isoude? So a couple of things here. Number one, you still have the problem of all these little Threon Greyjoys that never got sent. King Mark is proposing a different solution, which is, hey, instead of sending all of our sons, why don't I just, you know, through a marital alliance, you know, we can make this kind of peace treaty work. Which is a good idea. So Mark thinks it's a good idea. The counselors are trying to work it out. Note that nobody is considering what Isoude might think of the situation. And in fact, in this context, it'd be ludicrous to ask her because women have very little agency in these sorts of political marriages. Okay. The nobles... Okay. Then answered Mark, on this thing have I set my heart. Some means must be found. So he's the idea man. You guys got to carry it out. He looked towards Tristram, and the lords murmured among themselves, for they grew jealous of Tristram, fearing that he would be the next king of Cornwall if Mark had no children. Now Tristram knew of this, and wishing to prove to them that he had no ambitions towards the kingship of Cornwall, he arose and said, "My uncle and you, lords of Cornwall, this is a dangerous venture indeed, yet I will undertake it. For I have been once into Ireland, and there Queen Isoude cured me of my wound. And though against Tristram of Lyonesse, she had vowed eternal hatred and vengeance." So he's gonna take this on himself. Tristram set sail in one small ship with scarcely 30 men, and he came to Ireland at dead of night and anchored his ship in a quiet haven. "If any question you," he said to his faithful friend Cormenal, who had accompanied him, "say that we are merchants, and that I, your captain, have gone into the land to make bargains with the merchants of Ireland." Now, at that time, there was a dragon in Ireland, a fearful monster which devoured the people and laid waste the land, and King Gorman had promised that whoever should slay the dragon might have to wife his daughter, the fair Isoude. This Tristram had heard, and he went on shore that night fully armed and sought out the dragon's lair high among the burnt rocks above a fire-scorched valley. Early in the morning, when the red rays of the rising sun slanted down the valley like blood dripping between the rocks, Tristram saw three knights, and one following them, ride over the pass and down towards the lair of the dragon. And anon, he heard the dragon roar, and there came cries as of men in mortal anguish, and a cruel smoke curled up among the rocks. Then the one man who had followed the knights at a distance came galloping back the way he had come, spurring his horse to make it go yet faster. Now this was the seneschal of King Gorman, a cowardly knight and a braggart, who dared never face the dragon, yet who boasted often that full many times he had ridden in quest of it. Okay, we're going to pause here. So, story is getting good, because now we're getting like all of the awesome stuff that comes from a medieval story. Namely, you got a task that has to be completed, a quest, in other words, to get the girl's hand. So King Mark has his idea about getting Isolde's hand. Isolde's dad has a different idea, which is whosoever can defeat this dragon is going to get the girl. This is obviously an awesome storytelling device, as evidenced by the fact that after this story, you can see it many, many, many times in British literature. One. And then two, oh my lord, the retelling of this, I love it so much. Because Tristram is not seeing with his eyes the dragon. He is, it's kind of happening off stage and through sound effects, which is just delightful. So what he is seeing, just to recap here, he's seeing three knights going together, then pause, the other guy, and then he's not seeing, but he is hearing basically like, you know, dragon roar, and then, pause, the other guy running away. So that is just like, there's just a lot of comical element to it. It makes me think of that famous movie sound effect scream that you hear in all the movies. I can't remember what the name of it is. Anyway, that's funny. Okay, so Tristram rode quietly down the valley, and at length he saw the dragon standing over one of the knights whom it had slain. R.I.P. knight. A terrible monster it was, with great shining claws, scales of blue and green, and jaws breathing fire and smoke between sharp white teeth. I love that. It's a very satisfying dragon. That's like a dragon brand dragon. Tristram set his spear in rest and charged the dragon suddenly, his shield held well before him, and the monster turned at the sound of hooves and made ready to seize him with open jaws. Right well aimed Sir Tristram, so that the spear entered at the dragon's mouth and pierced deep towards its heart. Tristram leaped forward over the dragon's head, and the monster, screaming with rage and pain, slew the horse, and a blast of fire began quickly to devour it. But the spear, though the wooden handle charred swiftly away, left its sharp point deep in the creature's vitals, and it went screaming away into the rocky ravine, leaving the horse half eaten. So, Tristram, battles this dragon. I just want to very briefly point out that when it says that he has his spear in rest, it doesn't mean that he has, like, put the spear down. The spear in rest is more or less the position that you're going to hold the spear in for jousting, right? So he has it, I don't know the word in English, lo tiene como agachado, and then he's just going to, you know, charge that dragon, which he does in a very satisfying fashion. Okay, Tristram followed swiftly on foot and met the dragon at the valley's head. There, for an hour, the battle raged, Tristram sheltering behind rocks lest the scorching flame should destroy him. Many times he wounded it, yet might not slay it, but the spear point drew near to its heart, so that at last it rolled over in agony. Then Tristram rushed forward and drove in his sword right to the hilt. And so the dragon died, but in its dying, it breathed such a blast of flame and poison upon Tristram that his shield melted and dripped from his arm, and he fell to the ground half poisoned by its breath. Presently, however, he crept to the dead dragon and cut out its tongue, placing it in the pouch at his side. Then he began seeking for the way out of the valley, but ere long the poison overcame him, and he fell down in a deep swoon and lay like one dead. Then the false seneschal came silently into the valley. So if you remember from a little bit ago, this is the guy who follows the other knights, sees that they get incinerated, and then runs away. It's this guy. So this guy is coming upon the scene, and what is he seeing? Seeing the dead dragon. He's seeing Tristan. Maybe he's seeing opportunity. Okay, so then the false seneschal came silently into the valley, and he saw the dragon lie dead, and Tristram dead also, or so it seemed. Laughing to himself, that cowardly knight cut off the dragon's head, bounded upon his horse, and went with all speed to the court of King Gorman. "Lord King," he cried, "see, I have slain the dragon. Fulfill now your promise and give me in marriage your daughter, the fair Iseult." Okay, we are going to end this episode right here. Tristram has passed out. The other guy is taking credit for his dragon. Is Iseult going to have to marry the false seneschal? Is she going to end up with Mark? Is she going to end up with Tristram? I don't know, people. Got to wait till next time. That is the end of our episode. If you enjoyed the episode and if you are feeling so moved in your heart, consider giving me a rating, giving the podcast a rating, because that helps kind of get the word out about the podcast. All right. See you next time, guys.